Thank you, everyone, for being here. When I was invited back, I think it was earlier this fall, I had been reflecting already on just this idea of holiday spirit. Even October, it was already starting, as particularly with the children, right? In October, when the opportunity for free, almost unrestricted candy is just, yeah, so invigorating. And then for, many adults, there's, I think, like 20 some holidays between November and January of various faiths and backgrounds. And it seems that there's this very generous and unforgiving kindness that erupts during those fall winter months, where we're in many ways less resistant about being generous with our time, with gifts, with kindness. And then something happens mid-January. Maybe it fades, or there's sort of a switch that's flipped that, returns us to our whatever that sort of status quo is of being suspicious, maybe, or defended. And so I've been like reflecting on and talking about really since the fall, like what would that be like if we had this holiday spirit all year round, right? Where we're not withholding of kindness, or sharing food and laughter every opportunity we get. It just warms my heart to think of like meeting each other in that way in January and February and March, all year round. Right? And in many ways, like this is what we're practicing, what we're aiming for in our practice. Right, we sort of have these, excuse me, responsibilities as practitioners, right, to hear and apply wise view, right? We're interested in knowing the truth, and not only the sort of universal truths of, always unsatisfactoriness, change, and an impersonal nature. But this truth of our own views of the world, of ourselves, of one another, and really dedicating ourselves to establishing awareness, right? Those five faculties, right? Faith and energy, and this mindfulness, which in the middle, just rooting us, this act of remembering, right? Remembering that which prevents us from floating away or getting caught up, right, in carelessness or distraction. And also with this calming practice of concentration, right? A factor that's essential to all thought, right? And just deepens our capacity to for freedom and calm, both externally, internally, and wisdom, right? Not just studying, like learning what the tradition has to say, but also engaging in study, reflection, dialogue with our community, and this meditation, right? And all of these, energy, faith has this capacity for sort of exciting our nature. And even wisdom, this study, this learning, With the excitement sort of discovery. And our responsibility as practitioners is to establish this awareness and persevere all the time, not just when it's pleasant or convenient, right? Just like not kind, only kind during the holidays or whenever we're more relaxed around that. Zenju Earthland Manuel is a poet and a teacher in the Zen tradition. And she writes, and many of her teachings are really grounded in this real life experience, this intersection of practice and daily life. And this is from her. She says, "To be good people, we tend to bypass the messiness of our lives in order to enter the gate of tranquility. No matter which way we approach peace, it seems we must cross the burning threshold of human conditioning to enter it. So before we leap to the universal, the true essence, or spirit, why not start where we are as human beings? We must carve a path through the flames of our human condition. We must see it for what it is and bow to it. Not a pitiful bow, but a bow of acknowledgement. By acknowledging our human condition, we acknowledge that we might not know how to end hatred and that we are not superheroes. We are human beings." I love that. Just this acknowledgement that this life, this effort at being human, being a human being, it gets messy. It is, oftentimes it is messy, right? And the human desire to want to bypass that, to get to what's peaceful and calm and tranquil. Right? But there really is no other starting place than where we are. And the Brahma Viharas, which have been the core of my practice for many, many years, right, are loving support to this carving a path through the flames of our human condition. They loosen the power of fear, of doubt, of expectation, of disappointment. And they're certainly by no means magical, right? We still have to be intentional about our efforts, our actions, or else we fall into the zone of the near enemy, right? Or metta or loving kindness, that discriminating affection, right? Not this one, maybe not that one, right? Deciding who's deserving, who's not, right? And that's some positive qualities, but it isn't pure, pure love. Or pity, the near enemy of karuna or compassion. I've been reflecting a lot lately. Excuse me. Just having awareness of like all of the neutral people in my life as I bring my metta practice into my life as I'm walking around, driving around, and became particularly aware of the people who presumably are unhoused, who are outside, often at intersections or highway on-ramps with a message on a sign and ask for some sort of generosity, some kindness. And as as we soften, become more sensitive, tender in our practice, We see more, we feel more. And so, noticing my own inclination to turn away or get tight or have pity, or even the places, where maybe I'm indifferent, which is the near enemy of upekkha, equanimity. And so this responsibility to hold wise view, maintain awareness, it's not always easy, right? But these practices, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, are a solid guide for us. Bell Hooks, another poet, another scholar reflecting on who, a lot of her writings reflected on love with that, and not a romantic in a romantic sense, obviously, but this just care for one another. She calls it a love ethic. And she says, excuse me. She says, I know no one who has embraced a love ethic whose life has not become joyous and more fulfilling. The widespread assumption that ethical behavior takes the fun out of life is false. In actuality, living ethically ensures that that relationships in our lives, including encounters with strangers, nurture our spiritual growth. She says, behaving unethically with no thought to the consequences of our actions is a bit like eating tons of junk food. While it may taste good, in the end, the body is never really adequately nourished and remains in a constant state of lack and longing. Our souls feel this lack when we act unethically, behaving in ways that diminish our spirits and dehumanize others. And that just really resonates for me, this such striking language, dehumanizing others, our own spirits diminished. And we may not think of not seeing or not acknowledging other human beings is unethical. But the invitation is to really examine, stay close to, right, the state of mind or heart that causes us to create distance, have space, sort of create this othering. And more than anything, this practice invites us to undo as much as we're doing. Like part of a great deal of our work certainly is cultivating intentions in our daily life. But it's also largely a practice of renunciation, right? Training the mind to recognize these unskillful habits and views, preferences that we hold on to sometimes so very dearly, right? And one of the fruits of this setting down, relaxing, is that it sort of breeds simplicity, right? Breeds or increases the capacity for contentment. The Buddha didn't teach that we hate our old habits or our unskillful habits away, right? We get rid of them or kick them out entirely, but recognizing and creating balancing energies, balancing habits. And so when we're conditioned and inclined to holding on or withholding, right? We practice generosity all year round, right? I think that in the suttas, generosity and giving were like usually the first things that the Buddha discussed with people when they were encountering his teachings for the first time. It's at the, top of the list, or the begins the list of the paramis. And I think because, it's common to all of us. We have the capacity, no matter our station in life, to give. And we often think of this in terms of finances or tangible goods, but there are so many other ways, right, that we can give, whether it's our time, right, serving at our church or Dharma Center or our community, right? Contributing our talents and skills where we can and when we can. Or even simply being generous with a positive mindset, offering praise, offering acknowledgement. And depending on your family dynamics or maybe the part of the world that you grew up in, maybe that was not something that was cultivated. And it can be life-altering, just a few kind words. Or just a friendly care, affectionate. And when I say affectionate, I don't mean in a romantic sense again. This relaxed, sensitive way of showing up for one another. And this, in this way, like generosity really is this act of altruism, right? We're being selfless. What we get or how we might be perceived is not what's at the center, right? We are holding at center this heart who has unlimited capacity to care in any situation, right? When someone is meeting great success, when someone is experiencing great difficulty. And I just think how often, there's withholding or restraining of this care, right? Even the act of forgiveness, which, there's a couple dozen of us here, and if we went around, we'd probably all have a different definition of what forgiveness is. Right. And at its core, it's this not holding on. And this can be an act of generosity, an act of care, right? Somewhat like sacrifice or this relinquishing. It all has the flavor of letting go, not holding resentments or bitterness, but nor holding on to that which is like good and warm and positive in our lives. This is a sutta. I think this is like a summary sort of poem version, House on Fire. So, when the world is on fire with aging and death, one should salvage one's wealth by giving. What's given is well salvaged. What's given bears fruit as pleasure. What isn't given does not. Thieves take it away, or kings. It gets burnt by fire or lost. I'll read it again. So when the world is on fire with aging and death, one should salvage one's wealth by giving. What's given is well salvaged. What's given bears fruit as pleasure. What isn't given does not. Thieves take it away, or kings. It gets burnt by fire or lost. And so much of what blocks our own capacity for generosity, right, really lies in our own hearts, right? We sort of hoard our time, our energy, our money, right, for someday, some battle that may never come, right? Afraid that if it does come, we won't have what we need or what we want, that we'll be lacking in our last days. And so we hold on, nervous. Even about exposing our true heart's desire, right, for peace, for simplicity. This sort of hoarding activity or fear. Has the flavor, the elements of ego, right? The separating of me from you, us from them. Then there's this distinction between what we have, what's on this side, what's on that side. And then there's some sense of loss, right? If there's a crossing, like if the what's on this side goes to them. Or if they get what we have. And it's just useful. Like, this is our practice, right? It is useful to see, like Zenju Earthland Manual said, just the messiness that comes from these boundaries that we create that distort this natural impulse to give, to share. And I think it's important to acknowledge that certainly there are, I don't know, times or conditions where we have to be more mindful about what we're giving or how we're giving, right? So we don't want to, it could cause harm to us. Right, giving more money than we can actually afford to give. If we are giving money that's needed for medication or food or housing, right? Or you don't see hitchhikers much on the side of the road now, but even just awareness of safety and well-being, we want to give in a way that doesn't cause harm to the one who's giving or the one that's receiving. And sometimes we can question whether this practice is about sort of giving without boundaries. which isn't wise or safe in some situations, right? There are perhaps some people that have demonstrated themselves to be abusive, harmful in our lives. And so it's appropriate that we would have some boundaries and wouldn't open ourselves in ways that would allow them to cause harm. Right. And we can get, I think, sort of caught up in assessing, deciding ahead of time when something that we might give won't be needed or welcomed or might be a waste of time, which is a really interesting and possibly unskillful way to approach, right? Perhaps we've had some direct experience, like many of you maybe have elderly parents, and you've offered your own wise counsel. They don't listen, right? They may, or they may not, right? It's important that we're looking at, or we understand, like the intention behind the offering, right? And we'll take that example of the aging parent. Is the intention to, control, manage, sort of be the person that knows what's in their best interest? My father, who will be 90 this year, just bought a new car last year. And he was already driving a large vehicle, a Chevy Tahoe. It's a big vehicle. And so he wanted another Chevy Tahoe. And on the one hand, made perfect sense. It's familiar to him. He doesn't have to learn all new, all there's lots of new bells and whistles comparatively. And it's a giant vehicle, right? And so I worked on them, right? I tried show we went to dealerships and looked at all these other cars, smaller, still Chevy related. And it was too much, right? I was trying to control, manage his decision making. And he finally arrived at, you don't know what's best for me, right? And it's possible I may have pushed him into buying the Chevy Tahoe by trying so hard to get him to buy something else. But my wise counsel, certainly from a place of care, it w wasn't necessarily meeting him where he was. It was to direct him to where I wanted him to be. Right. And I imagine, you all have some ideas or some scenarios come to mind that we withhold, right? It could be a work project and they're just sort of entangled and not going anywhere, and you withhold an idea or. And it's not as simple as saying, yes, in this scenario, we withhold. In this scenario, we don't. Right? At every step, the invitation is to, tune into the heart to understand the intention. Right? And, yeah, I had a neighbor once that they were a young family. It was their first house. They didn't have a whole lot. And I had an old lawnmower. They needed a lawnmower. I had an old lawnmower. And so I don't remember if I gave it to them at very low cost or actually gave it to them. And that winter, it sat outside in the yard. all winter long. And I had all sorts of ideas about how one might take care of something that was gifted so generously. Right. But it was also sort of a lesson to me. Like I didn't have any resentments or regrets about that offering or being generous. But I also learned that this is how they're going to take care of something, right? Or at least at that juncture. And oftentimes we'll tie the action, our judgment about the action, and associate that with the quality of the person, right? And thus creating some space or judgment or distance in that relationship. So we can be prudent, and conserve while keeping the heart open, right? Conserve in those places and times where it might cause harm. This we're planting seeds or leaving a residue, I like to say, like everything we touch, everywhere we are, we leave an imprint. And it's not always readily available to us or easy to go back and clean up an imprint that leaves a harmful smudge. And so we can maybe start where it's easy, right? Start like where giving is feels natural, effortless, right? Where it actually brings us joy. And just do that more. Like, what would be, do that more. And we can always stretch ourselves, like, give a little bit more than we planned and see how that feels. I remember I was on retreat once at IMS, and I didn't have any, it must have been fall, and I didn't have anything to wear around the center that would keep my feet warm. And so I found a pair of Birkenstocks, actually, in the what it's not there anymore, sort of the lending room, if you will. And I was compelled to sort of make a trade, right? And so I had a scarf with me that was gifted by a friend, this lovely cashmere wool blend scarf that I left there intentionally. And it was a little more than I wanted to leave it because I did. And like I felt a little pinch, like, oh, that was really nice. Maybe I could have left something else. Right? No matter that I have plenty of scarves at home. And I actually didn't use that one a whole lot because it was a little scratchy. But there was some, little pinch to hold onto, this judgment about what's too nice to leave, or And I certainly see that in my mind when I see the unhoused people with their signs. And sometimes it's parents at outside at the grocery store. And I became I wasn't planning on like disclosing all this about myself, but it feels good and right. And You all feel good and right to me, so I'll just go for it. But like this narrative that just sort of floats in the back about someone's experience. I'm filling in the dots. I have no idea, right? And how I respond to people, but as an act of generosity, I don't know, many years ago, I thought, well, you can at least make eye contact with people, right? Offer a smile. They often wave. Even if I don't, if I choose not to give them anything or I don't have anything to give, can there be this act of kindness just through acknowledgement of another living being? And I see where my mind goes about, oh, well, it's so cold outside. I'm in Minnesota. It's been super cold for the last couple of weeks, like sub-zero temps. And at a couple on a couple of different occasions, there was a parent with a very young child outside. Now, my background and training is social work, and so I really my mind went to, okay, we need a plan. Where can you go? And this is all in my mind, right? And in the absence of, you know, talking, having a direct conversation with someone can either launch into fix it mode, or the other end of that spectrum is sort of ignoring, denying our capacity, our ability, our opportunity to help in some even small way. I think it was when I saw, someone outside with a sign. I think the most impactful sign that I've ever seen. And it said, I don't have it exactly. It said, being homeless is depressing, dangerous, and isolating. I am not your problem. And then I am not your responsibility. I just ask for like a simple some help or kindness. And I think it was so memorable and striking because it's so true. Like homelessness is incredibly dangerous. Especially, and isolating. And we know that a great percentage of folks who are living unhoused are living with mental illness, often untreated. And just seeing, even as a trained social worker, right, the mind's tendency to create a story, a narrative, and responding to that story, that narrative, as if it were true. And I don't have a great way to tie up this exploration that's very much present for me still, like noticing how I respond or don't to another human being in need. And that all of the things I've talked about, just noticing that tightness, that hoarding, like, oh, I have to take care of me and my family. And what if, you know, I give too much and don't have enough? And so I've just simply been practicing staying with that feeling, the feeling, not the thought, the feeling of constriction. Right. Which more often than not leads to some softening, some tenderness. And so, if it's in the morning, I'm at the grocery store. Sometimes I've come out with a breakfast sandwich and a coffee for someone, or some soup. And it doesn't mean those narratives aren't, that tape isn't going about, whatever. But it does mean that there's a willingness to keep pushing through, right? This fearful thought, this judging thought, to keep pushing through and see what happens. See what's on the other side. And not because, I'm trying to be generous or I've got to be this. It's actually being more curious than anything else, more curious than certain. I think that's a strategy, sort of deliberately picking a habit of stinginess or withholding and really just staying with it and looking at it. I actually started the practice, that practice of picking something and staying with it with my mother. My mother passed in 2020, and in my metta practice, she was my difficult person till the day she died. But at some point, a few years before she passed, I realized that, this fixation on our long-standing difficult relationship hurt most here, right? And not because she was intentionally or willfully hurting me, but because I was withholding, because I was sort of tight and stingy with care or even vulnerability. And it was sort of at a point of exhaustion, right? Like, I don't know what else to do. I am exhausted from defending and protecting. And so I practiced relaxing, practice compassion, practice generosity. Generosity of time. I would call her every day. Maybe a short conversation, 5, 10 minutes maybe. But this offering, this opening. And I think there's many ways to do that, right? Couples at the end of the day that express gratitude, or maybe it's just with yourself in your journal at the end of the day. At my job, we've started this sort of online bulletin board to post what's good, what's working. And even there, it's like, oh, I have so much work to do. I don't have time for that. Just like noticing that this tinge. So there's all sorts of ways that we can practice this pushing through, right? This generosity. It's not, maybe it's least about our tangible and financial resources and more about our, this heart mind that we're working to cultivate and soften. So maybe generosity looks like gathering people together, making connections, or reaching across the aisle, as they say, to listen to a different perspective, different experience. I think if we can remember to, stay interested in our innermost thoughts, the ones we don't want to tell anyone, and we don't want to go on Zoom on a Wednesday night talking about, right? But really being curious, are those innermost thoughts generous or forgiving, in praise of others? Are they understanding or compassionate? Or are we kind of still stuck in early default modes? These are my default modes, right? Judgy, sort of crispy, snippy, right? Withholding. And because we're practiced at sitting still and tuning in, we know what that feels like in the body. And it's simply a choice, what we cultivate. I think I'll close with this little bit. What the miser fears that keeps him from giving is the very danger that comes when he doesn't give. I will say, it's not sort of, I think that's from the sutta. It's certainly not as a threat, like, this is why you should give. Because there are definite rewards from being generous, right? And it's really about like what I've described, more easeful relationships, right? It's that you are one is dear and appealing, admired by good people, right? But it's this absence of contention, this absence of strain in our relationships. People say good things about you, right? That's the fruit of what the goodness that we're setting in motion, right? The legacy, if you will, of what we're leaving behind. And one doesn't stray from rightful duties, right? I think about just like that residue, that imprint. What is it? Yeah, that's left here. Not out of obligation, but an open, easeful heart that cares. What does that look like in action? And if you are a believer in past lives, multiple lives, this said that one of the rewards of generosity is being reborn into a good destination. Even if you don't believe in the multiple lives, what's the harm in being generous? Yeah. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you all so much for having me. It's very sweet to be in community with you. Very much appreciate your kind attention. Good night, everyone.